they can really pull it off, there will be a tremendous benefit synergy, you know, in the longer term.
Technology is driving the global race for control. It's Tuesday, March 5th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're glad to have you with us today. You can find us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Mandarin teaching finds a home in Uganda. New York's Chinatown in photos. STEM students decrease. Ice skating at the art gallery and a hip-hop dance school. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China has accused two Canadians of stealing state secrets days after Canada said it would hold a hearing this week on a U.S. request to extradite a Chinese tech executive accused of violating U.S. trade sanctions against Iran. In what China called a major development in the case, it accused former Canadian diplomat Michael Kovrig, who was detained in December, of gathering and stealing sensitive information and other intelligence in China since 2017. Businessman and entrepreneur Michael Spavor was accused of providing intelligence to Kovrig. China describes Spavor as an important contact for Kovrig. In the past, Spavor had had contacts with high-ranking North Korean officials, including leader Kim Jong-un. A Chinese statement said Kovrig's alleged behavior of gathering and stealing secrets and other intelligence for a foreign power has seriously violated Chinese laws. Both Canadians were detained shortly after Meng Wanzhou, chief financial officer of China's giant Huawei technology company, was apprehended in Vancouver at the request of the United States. A Canadian court is holding an extradition hearing Wednesday. She could be sent to the U.S. to face the Iran sanctions charges, but with appeals of a decision, it may be months before that case is resolved. Technology in the global race to gain the lead in the next generation of tech is behind much of the recent political and trade disputes. China is stepping up its efforts, announcing a long-awaited plan to link up its southern Pearl River Delta into a massive hub of technology, research, finance, and innovation. The possibilities and challenges of the project are both equally challenging and promising, according to analysts. Some describe the plan as an attempt to create a megacity to rival Silicon Valley, the U.S. technology powerhouse that is home to companies such as Google, Facebook, and Apple. But while Silicon Valley has a population of 3.1 million, the Greater Bay Area will link up 9 cities together with Hong Kong and Macau, with a total population of about 70 million, and the economic heft, state media argues, to drive the Chinese economy, let alone the world. The plan was announced recently. It's expected to be a prominent topic during high-level political meetings going on this month in Beijing. It's not necessarily new. China's opening up to the world more than 4 decades ago began in the South, and the Pearl River Delta has long been home to some of the country's leading companies from telecommunications, such as Huawei, to the internet giant Tencent, and a host of other technology and manufacturing enterprises. Adam Hsu, partner at OC&C Strategy Consultants, says China's grand plans often come together with a combination of support from the highest levels of government all the way to the grassroots level.
It's a natural evolution of economic growth, growth engine. If you really look at history, in China, a lot of the kind of top-down plan always had some bottom-up support. A lot of economic activities already happened there. Then you have a grand plan to first officially recognize, then to promote and further accelerate.
Hsu said that as labor costs rise in China, the country is looking to move up the individual value chain and program seeks to do just that, to push the region on to the next wave, be it the manufacturing of electric cars, financial services, or telecommunications. It's also aiming to drive investment to the area at a time when foreign funds flowing into the country are sagging. One key challenge, he adds, will be execution. The plan will tie together 3 different legal jurisdictions, and that makes the plan unique compared to the 2 other major megacity projects in China, the Beijing-Hubei-Tianjin merger and the Yangtze River Delta integration plan near Shanghai.
We just don't know how effective the top-down grand plan will guide independent growing forces at the city level to cultivate and be successful. So this part will be quite important challenge.
China has long had deep pockets when it comes to making investments that push forward technological advances. In many cases, however, that has led to overlaps in development and spending on technology, and in turn, oversupply, according to C.Y. Huang, partner of FCC Partners.
Each city on its own doesn't have anything new. The biggest challenge and the biggest beauty, if they can put it off, is linking all of these together.
One way the plan could do that is not just by lifting physical barriers, but the flow of people, information, and money. China has already taken major strides to overcome some of the physical obstacles, such as linking Hong Kong with Guangzhou and Shenzhou by high-speed rail, and its recent opening of the 55-kilometer-long Hong Kong-Zhuhai-Macau Bridge. But Huang says other barriers may prove to be a bigger challenge.
But I think it's really the system, the 制度's barrier. That is the challenge. If they can really pull it off, there will be a tremendous benefit synergy, you know, in the longer term. One is a communist country, another is a free society. Although they are talking about one country, two systems, you know, but still, you know, it's different.
Huang adds that the world shouldn't underestimate the social and political aspect of the challenges China is facing as it tries to compete head-on with Silicon Valley, because we're talking about people. Our thanks to VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide and Joyce Huang for contributing this story. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Strong resistance to trade deal brewing in China. China accuses two Canadians of stealing state secrets. With military exercises canceled in South Korea, experts express concern about impact. Trump cites cost as reason for halting U.S.-South Korea war games. Huawei executive sues Canada for rights violations. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Spreading Mandarin language learning around the world has been a priority for the government in Beijing for many years, but for many, Mandarin tends to be a difficult language to learn. In Africa, economics may help spread the language. As Uganda's population increases, many young people are finding it difficult to find jobs that pay well. A government directive to introduce the teaching of Mandarin Chinese in schools may offer better employment opportunities, as Halima Athumani reports from the town of Luwero.
In Uganda, Mandarin Chinese is called the language of the future. And here, at Everest College in Luwero District, secondary students recite a poem about treasuring life. China is a major trade partner and investor in Africa, and many countries are encouraging their citizens to learn the language. Last year, Uganda's Ministry of Education named 35 schools countrywide where the Chinese language would be taught. The decision was driven by the ties between the countries, says Grace Waguma, director of the National Curriculum Development Center.
There is a lot of economic activities, infrastructure development, medical, name it, that China is working with Uganda. And many of our people, the Ugandans, are trading with China. So China has become a country that we need to get to know and get into it. And the only way we can do it is also through the languages.
Chinene Charles is one of the students learning Mandarin at Everest. He thinks the language will open up job opportunities.
I'm interested in learning Chinese because it can help me to be employed in Chinese companies. And if I have a friend who knows Chinese, can get a job and invite me to act as an interpreter in Chinese anniversaries.
For the last 4 years, the Confucius Institute at Makerere University has been instructing students in Chinese. The students are now being assigned to different schools in the country to teach the language. Namisi Moses Apollo says that he was a poor student in his regular schooling and he worried about finding employment. But he says that for him, learning Chinese was easy, and upon graduation, he was immediately asked to start teaching in a pilot class in Luero. According to Namisi, there are vast opportunities in Uganda for people who can teach Chinese, though he notes that in most cases, it's the Chinese government paying the salaries and one has to be very professional.
The market is vast, open, but you also have to be, I would say, a titan at negotiations to get the best out of it. You need to give it your best. You need to play your S at last. That is how you can be able to get the job. So you have to be not only good at Chinese language, but also at the culture and the communication skills.
Lao Da Zhu Shang Fei. Yes, I remember those kids used to sing.
Visiting Chinese officials have over the years emphasized what they call the template of Africa-China cooperation. China has funded many large infrastructure projects in Uganda, including the 600-megawatt Karuma hydropower project with a price tag of $1.8 billion, and a highway between Kampala and Entebbe, which cost $350 million. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Luero, Uganda.
Happening now in Asia, President Donald Trump says Democrats' decision to question his former lawyer Michael Cohen while he was overseas may be a reason his talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un failed. Cohen, who was Trump's lawyer for a decade, strongly implied Trump committed crimes while president. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Back in 1981, photographer Bud Glick made his way to Manhattan's Chinatown with a camera in hand and a plan to document life there. He was attracted to the people in Chinatown, who were reluctant to let a stranger into their largely closed-off world. But all that changed when residents began seeing Glick's photographs. Anna Nelson reports for VOA from New York as Anna Rice narrates her story.
History and context turned these pictures into a treasure. They document life in Manhattan's Chinatown at a time when it was one of the most closed communities in New York.
When I first started doing this work, I was 29 years old, and now I'm 67.
Bud Glick began taking the black and white photographs in 1981. The Museum of Chinese in America asked him to photograph Chinatown. He quickly became captivated.
My impression was the sheer population density, the vibrant street life, just blew me away.
But it took residents a while to warm up to him.
So I'm walking down the street. People are saying, no picture, no picture. I even had someone throw a bucket of water at me once. Not the bucket, but the water. But I was walking down the street, and all of a sudden, it's a cold January day. All of a sudden, a man named Frankie Wong turns to me and with a big smile on his face says, take my picture. So for me, that's an invitation.
After residents saw the photographs, they invited him into their lives. Cramped laundry rooms, tiny closets where men played mahjong, small apartments, and untidy clothing factories. Glick digitized the pictures over a period of 30 years and published them online. Then, one day, he received an email with a picture attached. It was a photo of Frankie Wong, the subject of his first photo in Chinatown.
And then he says, just to show you what it was like for me growing up in Chinatown, I'm attaching a photograph of me with my father and my little brother.
Glick immediately sent the young men more pictures of him and his family. Today, the photos document an era in Chinatown that has changed since. The community is not as closed or tightly knit. Many immigrant communities have dissolved and blended with others. But in much of Chinatown, Glick still remains a very special guest. For Anna Nelson in New York, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Coming up, a disturbing drop in very smart students. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. The chief financial officer for China tech giant Huawei is suing the Canadian government, its border security agency, and the National Police Force for rights violations. Lawyers for Meng Wanzhou have filed a civil suit claiming misfeasance in public office and false imprisonment. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for more on top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, White House officials are worried that unless more American students study math and science in the United States, the U.S. won't be able to compete with China, India, and other nations. The U.S. administration has just published a five-year plan to boost the number of kids who go into science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM subjects. VOA Shahar Majid has more on this report narrated by Bejan Hamdard.
Kyrie Beckett is a junior at the University of District of Columbia studying electrical engineering.
I chose STEM because it seemed to be the right path for me based off of my family values. It's really the best way to go in terms of gaining an education and doing something relevant in the world.
Unlike Beckett, most American students of his age prefer to study anything but STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. According to a recent report by Forbes, STEM departments in U.S. colleges have plenty of students, but many are foreign, and education experts worry not enough are Americans. American University's Director of Graduate Teacher Education Program, Carolyn Parker, says images that portray scientists and mathematicians as nerds discourage teenagers at a time of life when self-image is important.
They don't entice students to want to become involved. You look at programs like the Big Bang Theory. And, you know, scientists are nerds.
To recruit more American students in STEM fields, the White House five-year strategic plan tries to remove social and financial barriers to a rewarding education in technical fields.
Yeah, I will take care of it.
University of District of Columbia's engineering school's Dean Devdas Shetty believes many students avoid STEM because they think they have better options.
They see opportunities in sports, opportunities in philosophy or history or arts, and they see examples of people excelling because the TV influences a lot.
Parker believes that to compete with countries like China and India, the country needs to encourage STEM education at a young age.
Make sure that students from the time they're in early childhood to elementary school to middle school to high school through college and going out into higher education and the workforce have strong and positive STEM experiences so that we can remain competitive with countries like China and India.
Kyrie Beckett believes that support and encouragement from his family is what pushed him to choose STEM. And it is something he wishes for every student selecting a field of study. For Sahar Majid in Washington, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. China has accused two Canadians of stealing state secrets days after Canada said it would hold a hearing this week on a U.S. request to extradite a Chinese tech executive accused of violating U.S. trade sanctions against Iran. China calls it a major development in the case. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, water turns to ice when it gets cold enough, and that physical state changes. A turn in a splashing summertime fountain in front of one of Washington's museums into a smooth surface for skaters. Valja Baraputri takes us to the Sculpture Garden Ice Rink.
Winter, for many Americans, is a time to hit the ice, and cities around the country offer outdoor and indoor skating rinks. There are at least 8 seasonal outdoor ice rinks in Washington, and one of the most popular is located in the Sculpture Garden of the National Gallery of Art. After Zamboni smoothed the 2 centimeters of ice into a glistening surface, it's ready for skaters. They pay for a 2-hour session and can rent skates if needed. The ice rink became a popular winter destination after it opened in 1999. It attracts local and tourists who just want to have fun, but also those who want to take their skills to a higher level. Among them is 8-year-old Bella Porter. She first hit the ice before her second birthday and has been skating seriously for the past 4 years.
I like that it's outdoor. I like that you can really breathe in fresh air, and I really, really like all the sculptures, all the stuff around it.
Bella's mother, Emmy Porter, holds skating lessons here. She encourages kids and adults too to take classes to gain more confidence on ice.
So on Fridays, we offer a coffee club skating that's around noon. So it's a class, a 45-minute class that's just more social. So people of different levels can come and skate and then, you know, enjoy some coffee or hot chocolate as well. In all of our beginning classes, we actually start off the ice. So we get the skaters comfortable off the ice and we demonstrate the safest way to fall and get up. And that actually usually takes away some of the fear.
Because the National Gallery of Art wants visitors to enjoy some of the museum's collection while skating, the ice rink is surrounded by sculptures by American and European artists. This stainless steel tree, called Graft, was created by New York sculptor Roxy Payne. French-American artist Louise Bourgeois is perhaps best known for her sculptures of spiders, like this one, towering over the rink. This bronze rabbit is Thinker on a Rock by Barry Flanagan from Wales. If not skating, visitors can sit and enjoy the 21 sculptures along with a slice of pizza or a cup of hot chocolate. Valdia Baraputri, VOA News, Washington.
Jason Cerda is a professional dancer and recording artist, performing on stage with many big-name musicians. Now he's teaching young performers how to dance, as we hear from VOA's Maxim Moskalkov.
Jason Cerda has been dancing since he was 5. Today in his 30s, he has made it his profession, performing around the country and teaching hip-hop to young dancers.
I've actually honestly been dancing my whole life before I was a singer. I danced since I was 5 years old. I would do talent shows at my schools, at my high schools. I would watch Michael Jackson on TV and Usher and Justin Timberlake and people like that, and I would just look up to them.
Cerda wanted to give back to the Northern Virginia community where he grew up, so he opened his dance studio here instead of in his current home of Miami, Florida.
There's so many good dancers in this area that don't get the exposure that they deserve. Everybody always feels like they need to go to New York or LA or Miami, and I disagree. I think that there's a lot of talent here. Just because DC is known for politics doesn't mean that we can't be known for entertainment as well.
Cerda hopes his studio will become a launching pad for future dance professionals. It offers classes in 20 different styles of dance, from hip-hop and jazz to ballet and belly dance, and celebrity choreographers make frequent appearances. Cerda and studio co-founder Rana Fadul say it's never too late to start dancing if you're passionate about it.
If you have talent and you're willing to practice and to put in the hard work and the time to be a dancer for Jennifer Lopez or Ricky Martin or Beyonce or whoever it is that you're aspiring to dance for, it just takes practice and determination and the right training. And what we try to do is bring that industry level training.
When you go to LA, it's very, very competitive there. You can't just be good in LA, you have to be amazing. So the goal here is to prepare you as much as we can in every style so that when you go there, you're not completely lost and you have a chance to succeed.
But not all the students want to be professional dancers. For some of them, dance lessons are just a fun way to work out and meet people.
What's really great about all the dance classes is you get a workout while you're dancing.
Cerda says learning the moves for hip-hop or any other style of dance is not that tricky. But performing them accurately, quickly, and smoothly involves a lot of practice and time. But so does chasing a dream. Maxim Moskalkov for VOA News, Alexandria, Virginia.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us on iTunes and SoundCloud. Find us on the radio, like CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there who has tuned in today. And as always, we give our thanks to Director Tracy Carter engineer Aiden Utku, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, that's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.